Good to have you join us on Juno Afternoon today. I'm Rhonda McBride. Some of the conversations coming your way, pouring not just beer, but love for the community. How Juno breweries are teaming up to build a cabin. Mark your calendar. Why February is Romeo month. Romeo the wolf, that is. From floods to roof failures to avalanches, the weather takes its toll on Juno and its emergency programs department. Some of the conversations you can look forward to on this Wednesday's Juno Afternoon. In the forecast for tonight and tomorrow morning, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and snow. Lows in the mid-30s, highs in the upper 30s, winds out of the southeast around 10 miles per hour. Very little snow accumulation expected tomorrow, with the snow level at about 1,500 feet. For Thursday night, the snow level will drop to 1,100 feet. Rain and snow in the forecast, with rain more likely near downtown Juneau and Douglas tomorrow night. Lows in the mid-30s with light winds, and as we head into the weekend on Friday, we're still in a pattern of rain and snow, with snow in the morning, rain later on, snow level at 800 feet, highs around 40 degrees. Friday night, lows in the mid-30s with rain and snow continuing through Saturday in the forecast. Highs around 40 degrees, but Saturday night perhaps a turning point. We'll see temperatures back down into the upper 20s. Snow is likely. Rain is still possible. Snow more likely for Sunday with highs in the mid-30s. Sunday night through Tuesday, mostly cloudy with a chance of snow. Cold weather seems to be keeping rain out of the mix as we head into next week. Sunrise tomorrow morning at 8:09, sunsets at 4:11 in the afternoon, a total of 8 hours, 42 minutes of daylight.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akwan. The Tlinédi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on what were once tide lands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from their homes from these tide lands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages, and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and the future.
Hans and Gress, ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta khanakhaya ha anikak gunish cheese.
Ganesh Cheesh for being here with us today. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Well, if you love craft beers and you love skiing, this is an event you want to mark on your calendar. Or if you just simply have cabin fever. But we're taking cabin fever to a new level. It's about having the fever, the cabin fever, to build a new cabin at Eagle Crest. And so joining us now to talk about the Pour the Love fundraiser, we have Megan Chambers with Forbidden Peak Brewery, Evan Wood with Devil's Club Brewing, and then we also have Dave Scanlon, who is Eagle Crest General Manager. So, Megan, for a moment, if you don't mind, can we rewind the tape back to last year when the breweries teamed up to raise money for the Haines landslide disaster? I mean, that was a pretty impressive fundraiser, as I recall.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having us. And we're thrilled to bring it back and to honor the success of last year's event, which we've got to give big props to Andy Klein, who was one of the main organizers of the very first Pour the Love event. All four Juno breweries came together for the first time ever in support of Haynes and the Chilkat Valley Community Foundation in response to that extreme weather event. So we were thrilled to partner and to do an event that utilized both to-go and on-site options, and then to donate all the proceeds over to the Chilkat Valley Community Foundation to help with operations post that landslide.
That's really impressive, especially in the time of COVID, where it's kind of harder to get things organized and you don't have kind of the social connections you normally do. So how much did you ultimately wind up raising and then leveraging with that money?
We raised $18,000 locally, so amongst Junoites and then anyone else from out of town who participated online, purchased passports and T-shirts, and then the Rasmussen Foundation matched for a total of $36,000 that year, which was awesome.
That is $36,000. That's really impressive. So, Evan, I want to ask you about the potential for this year. What kind of a goal have the four breweries set?
Sure. Yeah, thanks. We're not overly optimistic that we'll have as much success raising money as we did for our neighbors over in Haynes, because that was a real heartfelt and unique response that the community had. But we're hoping to raise $10,000 this year to get enough money to finalize the construction of a new cabin up at Eagle Crest.
So I wanted to ask you, Dave Scanlon, who's the manager for Eagle Crest, I mean, how much does it cost to put in one of these cabins?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rhonda. So this has kind of been a that we're repurposing something that many people forgot about. So we're doing a really neat renovation on the old Tubing Park storage cabin. So it's kind of a utilitarian building, but really in a perfect location, right next to the Porcupine area, just steps off of the parking lot. So we've kind of secretly been working on this behind the scenes, and then was just thrilled when Evan and Megan and Sky and the folks from the breweries reached out with this idea of raising some funds to help with a cabin project. And so this just kind of popped right to mind as a natural fit. You know, we've made a lot of progress kind of secretly, as we know the Junoites are really passionate about their cabins, and the funding that they're hoping to raise through this effort, I think will get us across the finish line and finish our renovation. So this is going to be similar to an Eagle Beach cabin. We're hoping to have it be as close to ADA accessible as we can. Be great for families with little kiddos that like to travel with a lot of supplies for their little kiddos and want to get out and do something fun. And we're hoping to have electricity in the cabin and everything. So this is going to be a fun thing for the community, as we learned just not that we had any doubt prior to the Hilda Dam cabin, but we've learned firsthand just how much demand and how passionate Juno is about their backcountry cabins.
That is really great that you don't have to totally start from scratch, because that would be a lot more expensive. So maybe this will work. If they can raise at least $10,000, they'll be able to get this all fixed up. When would you anticipate that cabin being available?
You know, we're cautiously optimistic that we'll be ready for early to mid-summer launch. We've gotten a decent amount of work done, so that's kind of what we're targeting in on, you know, just capitalizing on the summer months when people are wanting to be out romping around and camping and hiking and be able to put something new and exciting out there for everybody.
Well, you mentioned the Porcupine area, so now I understand why on the poster that promotes this, and it is a really cool poster of a bear and a porcupine exchanging some brews around a campfire that's outside a cabin. I just love that artwork. But I guess this artwork does figure into the fundraiser. Do you want to explain, Megan?
Yeah, sorry, unmuted myself there. Jessica Hanlon is a local artist. She owns Frost and Fur, a screen printing company. So many Junoites will probably recognize her work. So she did the artwork for us this year. We love it. She said it's what she imagined happens at the cabins when we're not there. All the animals are hanging out using the sites, which I think is awesome. The artwork, at least a black and white version of the artwork, will be on a stainless steel carabiner camp mug. So everyone who purchases a passport online and turns it in the month-long time frame they have to complete the beer passport will get one of these stainless steel mugs when they turn it in, which is their reward for doing it, and they can take it out to the new cabin.
So Megan mentioned passports. Evan, how does this work with your passports? Because it's not like you buy tickets, but you buy an opportunity to go out and try different beers. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the idea. So the we've done a couple of these passport programs before, and people really like them. They're just a fun way to get out, get around town, go check out everything that's going on at each brewery. And so when you purchase a ticket, you can bring in your proof of purchase, and you can exchange that for a passport, which is this fun little book. Every brewery has a stamp, and so you go to each brewery, get a stamp, and it'll also give you the opportunity to try one of these specialty beers that each brewery is releasing for the event. And the non-beer drinkers, there's also non-alcoholic options, and there's no purchase of anything necessary to get your stamp. We just want to get people out and about coming in. And there's also going to be to-go options available for those beers as well. If people want to stay at home and try the beers there, they're more than welcome to do that as well. And then once you get all your stamps, you get to exchange it for that really cool carabiner mug. And Eagle Crest also was kind enough to add some other incentives to all the participants, because everybody knows that the cabins go quick when they come for sale. So we wanted to give people a little bit of an added bonus for participating and helping the cabin get made. So we're going to raffle off the first night free at the cabin for one of the participants, and then another 20 additional preemptive booking opportunities. So we'll contact 20 people before the sales go online and allow them to book whatever weekend night they want ahead of time. So you don't have to be sitting there hitting reload when the cabin becomes available. And so those extra incentives are going to be a really cool, exciting way to hopefully get more people excited about helping the cabin get made.
Dave, imagine being the first in the cabin. What is that person going to get to experience? What view will they have? And what kind of a mood will be in the cabin?
Yeah, so there's going to be great views. There's going to be a nice big deck on the front of the cabin. So a great spot to watch the sunset. So you're going to be looking up the Fish Creek Valley at the High East Peak and the East Bowl Chutes and the Hilda Valley. It's just a great view looking over the Porcupine Slopes. And I think a lot of people are going to enjoy the deck space as well. So they can really kind of immerse themselves in the noise of the little creek that runs behind the cabin and just all the noises and smells of being up there on the mountain.
Wow, that sounds wonderful. That is a wonderful incentive that you're offering. So I have to ask about the beers, because for beer lovers, this event is an incentive in and of itself to go out and enjoy some. Are there special brews that are made for this event, just particularly for the event, or are they just other brews that you have in stock, or you bring them out just for this?
Every brewery is brewing a beer specifically for the event and releasing it on the first night of the event, which is the first Friday of February, so February 4th. Devil's Club is going to be brewing a blueberry pastry stout. So it's going to be a stout with blueberries and some other pastry type additions to make it nice and flavorful. Alaskan Brewing is bringing back a favorite, oatmeal stout. Long forlorn to have returned. Everyone's going to be very excited to get oatmeal stout back in the rotation. And then Barnaby Brewing is going to be releasing a barrel-aged barley wine, a nice, rich, strong beer. And then I'll let Megan speak for Forbidden Peak.
We have a Scotch barrel-aged imperial stout that we'll be releasing. We're super excited. It will be our first barrel-aged beer that goes out to the public. We've been sitting on quite a few barrels for a while, and so we're excited to finally release that.
This is a really interesting business model, aside from a fundraiser, where you have four entities that are competitors, maybe. I don't know if you consider yourself competitors, but going in together, do you find that because you do this together, that you actually wind up generating more long-term business after the fundraiser?
Yeah, I wouldn't say any of us consider each other competitors. It's been a really collaborative and welcoming atmosphere. Forbidden Peak is the newest brewery amongst the four, so we were lucky to have such a welcoming community when we opened. Although Pour the Love is the first time all four Juno breweries have sponsored an event by themselves together, it's not the first time we've collaborated, and there's a lot of behind the scene work that we all do to help each other amongst supply shortages and getting beer up to festivals and down to the rest of the United States. So we're always super happy to have a chance to work together.
So Evan, do you think that lifting all boats, so to speak, helps all of you at the same time?
For sure. No, but I passionately believe that. And I think it's also, you know, Juno as a town certainly has a tendency to get stuck in their little corners. And so it's also a really cool opportunity for the regular patrons of the Valley Brewery, like Forbidden Peak, to have an excuse to come downtown. It's not that hard to find parking. You'll figure it out and try some downtown brews, and likewise for the other way around. And so it's just a great opportunity to get everybody kind of swapping around town and trying out the other places and sharing the same thing that we all like, which is tasty, tasty beers.
And just really quick, Evan, how has everybody been doing it, sort of, because we're now going on our third year of COVID. How are the breweries in general weathering this?
Well, we're getting used to it. we actually realized, I was talking with my other co-owners yesterday, and we realized that we've just passed the threshold. We've been open longer in COVID than out of COVID. So this is officially the norm. So we're making it through. It's been a struggle. We're really hoping that things will continue to turn around, because the past couple of years have been a big time challenge. But there's hopefully continually little glimmers of light at the end of the tunnel.
And if you get that new cabin built, everybody will feel a lot of glimmering and joy. So, all right. Thanks so much, the three of you. Just quickly, Megan, before we leave, you want to let people know where to go if they want more information?
Yeah, you can visit any of our websites or links in our social media pages. Our tickets are hosted through Brown Paper Tickets, so ultimately you'll purchase your passport through there. And then the event officially begins on Friday, February 4th.
All right. Well, we're looking forward to seeing what the final number is, and I hope you meet. And not just meet your goal, but beat your goal. So good luck with that. Thanks so much for joining us. We've had Megan Chambers with us, Evan Wood, and Dave Scanlon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio, Facebook, email, your favorite bulletin board. Every day you're inundated with information, and yet you still miss something you wanted to know. At the City and Borough of Juneau, we work hard to tell you about city-related services, public meetings, policy decisions, and so much more. But is it working? How are you getting CBJ information, and how could we deliver better? Go to juneau.org/survey to tell us. That's juneau.org/survey.
Up next, remembering Romeo the Wolf in a very Juno kind of way. You are listening to Romeo, the wolf who came to Juno. Though he was killed by poachers, he still lives in the hearts of many in Juno, much loved by those who watched him play with dogs and wander on the outskirts of town. Well, he returns in a big way next month with a number of events to honor his memory. Todd Hunt, a Juno composer, is organizing some of those events as part of the Orpheus Project, which includes music composed just for Romeo. So this is a tremendously multifaceted project. Can you tell us what all the moving pieces of this are?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. So it is confusing. So hang on, everybody. We've got lots of different things. So actually, let me start by saying that I find the whole story of Romeo the Wolf just fascinating because, you know, he was a wild creature. We don't know exactly what he was thinking. We don't have a lot of the facts. All we have are what people saw. So instead of doing the normal thing like I might have done, I wanted to hear from lots of different artists and lots of different ways of making art, not just music, but poetry and visual arts and dance and everything. So that is part of why this is such a big sprawling thing. So on the maybe more non-musical side, we've got a photo exhibit starting first Friday at the Jack in February. We've got a couple of folks curating this exhibit from photographers who sent in their things, and we're picking 20 of the best images, which we will then print and put up for people to see. And we'll also auction them off. So there's that, which is a kind of a big deal. There's a fireside chat that Nick Chans is going to do at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, February 11th at 7 p.m. The Juno Nordic Ski Club is doing a Romeo race February 12th, I believe that is, at 10 a.m. Boy, what else? Oh, right. There's a whole other thing on the music side. Joel Bennett and Elena Levy have gotten together and written a piece about 20 minutes long for five instrumentalists and narrator that we are hoping to get into the schools, actually, and perform. It's designed to go into classrooms and sort of teach people about Romeo and give some kind of very thoughtful ideas about who Romeo was. The text is by Joel Bennett, who knew Romeo very well. Then our biggest program, which is called Wolf Songs, will have two big pieces on it, cantatas, really. One by Emerson Eads and Dave Hunsacker called Black Wolf for chamber orchestra, narrator, and chamber choir. The chamber choir being Vox Borealis, led by Sarah Radke Brown. And my piece on that program, which I wrote, is A Wolf Called Romeo, text by Nick Jans, who wrote the book of the same name. So that is February 18 through 20 at Thunder Mountain High School. My piece is 17 instrumentalists, two singers, a soprano and a baritone, and dancers, professional dancers, as well as some local dancers, all choreographed by Genevieve Carson, who is a Juno girl, grown up here, but living in LA right now, working as a dance professional.
Wow. So how do you go about writing a musical piece for a wolf?
I thought kind of interesting. I had been talking with Nick Jans for a little while, and once we kind of settled on some excerpts from his book, and actually, I should say, this is at the beginning of COVID, and so I had nothing to do. I was, like, pretty much totally unemployed, so I became a full-time composer, which was wonderful because I was able to go to my studio and just sit at the piano and play things and come up with ideas. The great idea I came up with was, listening to videos of Romeo howling, and I took the pitches, or, you know, very approximate pitches that Romeo would howl, and turned it into a musical motive, a sound, I guess, and built the whole, this hour-long piece, more or less off of four notes that I got from his howl.
Huh, that is very curious.
Yeah.
So Nick Jan seems to be sort of at the center of this, his book about Romeo, A Wolf Called Romeo.
Well, I read the book for the first time in 2015, thereabouts, very shortly after it came out, and immediately thought, I need to make this into an opera. And the opera idea, could never really figure out how one would do that with a wild wolf. We don't know any facts about him other than what people saw and wrote down or talked about. So we don't really have a story. We just have a whole bunch of really vignettes and lots of different viewpoints. And so I eventually, it took frankly a few years to figure out that we needed to get lots of different artists on board so that we would have different takes on what Romeo meant to them and what Romeo meant to Juno. And on a greater thing, it's like, what is our place as humans living next to this wild world? Like, when they kind of come together, sometimes it can be okay, sometimes it's bad, but in this case it was for the most part magical. It needs to be dealt with, I guess, is not a good way to put it, but explored.
So the book is called A Wolf Called Romeo, and mm-hmm. I guess the piece that you composed has the same title,
right,
with seven movements.
Right.
It's an epic, I guess.
Yeah. So the soprano and the baritone that I had mentioned sing Nick's text. The baritone is sort of like Nick. I try not to put a personality onto, or a character, I should say, onto what they're singing. But the baritone is basically Nick. He's a narrator, sort of describes what has happened. The soprano, however, is a person from Romeo's time experiencing these things in the moment and sort of telling us about it as they're happening. And it's only at the end, at the memorial service, where they kind of meet up at the same time.
So you have seven movements that you've composed. How long is that?
So it's just over 60 minutes.
Wow.
I was shooting for 45 minutes, actually, and there's so much great text that Nick gave me to use that I could only throw away so much. And there's lots of feelings that go along with that. And I mentioned that the dance is, I think, a very important part of this piece. Each movement has its own dance episode as well. So you could almost think it's like 14 movements, kind of. You'll have the vocal section, and then the dancers come out and sort of explore what just happened or what is about to happen. So it's sort of big form stuff. I think it'll keep people's attention.
It's just hard to grasp as you describe it, but we have an excerpt from this opus, so to speak. So tell us what we should expect to hear.
Okay, so this excerpt is from the sixth movement. So we're getting pretty close to the end now. Well, anybody who's read the book, I'm sure, remembers the story where Nick is sitting on the side of Mendenhall Lake when it's frozen, but it's maybe very early spring. It started to thaw, so there's a sheet of water over the ice, so it looks like a lake. It doesn't look like a frozen lake. And Romeo's on the other side and sort of looking around, and it stands up and just starts walking across the water. And this magical moment that was very effective to him, it really affected me as well. So that's what the movement is about. And the music we're about to hear is sort of taking off right after that happened. So to me, it's sort of what feeling we have after seeing that.
All right, let's listen to a bit. So this part of the music was what was inspired by Nick Jans's description of Romeo crossing the lake. There's spring meltwater over it, and even though it's frozen, it looks like Romeo is walking on water. This next part, though, is darker. It's the foreshadowing of Romeo's death when he's shot and killed.
It kind of gets into the precarious situation that Romeo found himself in his last moments. Although I don't really write it per se, but yeah, I'll sort of let the dancers do their talking about that in a very abstract way, of course.
That music really does drive home the tragic loss of Romeo. And, you know, it's kind of like a wake for a wolf. But, you know, some may ask, is Romeo really worth all this much trouble to memorialize him in song, dance, performances?
Any wolf, probably no. But the idea of what Romeo represents, I think, is worth all of the trouble. It's not necessarily that we are saying Romeo is the greatest wolf that ever lived. I mean, maybe, but to me, that's not the point. The point is more our connection as humans with the wild world that is right on our doorstep, and how magic can happen there, and our connection with that magic is to me what it's all about, because something extraordinary happened. It could have been a wolf, it could have been a bear, a porcupine. The point is, it's about really what happened rather than who the, you know, protagonists were.
This is really hard to picture what this is going to be like, but this is like a 7-movement piece of music. There will be dancing to accompany it. There will be singing and some narration through this.
Yeah. So in my piece, there isn't any narration, but I don't think I even explained the structure of the whole concert. So the first half is Emerson Eads and Dave Hunsacker's Black Wolf that has narration and a choir along with the chamber orchestra. And then intermission, second half, is with my piece, you know, the singers and the dancers, as well as an orchestra.
So we have what you have called a rough cut of Emerson Eads' composition, The Black Wolf. And it's not anything like what the final product is going to be like, but was created to kind of give us a feel for what we are going to experience. So can you tell us a little bit about this piece that we're going to play next?
Yeah, so yes, it is a rough cut. And that, yes, that is my voice. And I promise I will not be doing the narration at the performance. We will have somebody, you know, better doing that. But the orchestral sound you hear is a computer rendition. So there are no humans doing that. So I had to take the text and then just record it and, you know, in my computer, sort of place it in the right place in the music. That's the way we do things.
Ultimately, will there be an orchestra that will play these?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, the Black Wolf piece has 12 instrumentalists, along with the chamber choir and narrator. And my piece is 17 instrumentalists with two singers and dancers.
Okay, so eventually what we're going to listen to is a live performance with a live narrator, and we're going to be asked to use our mind's eye to remember Romeo, which I think is kind of the best part about this. So let's give it a listen.
In the middle of the lake, the skier freezes. She has seen something emerging on the western bay. She's not sure what. Somehow, I can tell that she's frightened by it. The dogs see it too. They freeze. Their tails curl between their legs. Now he comes into my sight. Black, jet black, on the white snow, like a vision, like a dream, like a ghost. Something ancient about him, primordial, otherworldly, or something profoundly of this world, but not the human world. He stands majestically still. Somehow he draws the dogs to him. They cower. They seem to shake, but they go to the phantom, powerless. The skier stands frozen, watching. I imagine she is frightened, thinking she is about to see her dogs torn to pieces by this thing from the wilderness. The dogs are close to the wild wolf now. I can see he is twice as big as the shepherd. He touches his nose to theirs, tail straight out, a canine greeting.
It is hard for people to get their arms around it, but maybe you could help us by explaining to us what we're supposed to take away from honoring Romeo in so many different ways.
Yeah, like I said, it's finding or celebrating that connection that we can have with the wild world that's out there, seeing that there are things bigger than ourselves. Artists are always looking for inspiration, and I find that inspirational, and the whole story of Romeo inspirational, and passing on that inspiration to an audience is the greatest thing I think we can do.
Did you have a personal connection with Romeo?
You know, I didn't. I was living out of the country, actually, for most of the time that Romeo was around. I heard about him and was completely fascinated, and remember very strongly when he was found dead. It really affected me, even though I never actually saw him.
Well, I guess you read Nick Jans's book, so I guess it gives you a tie to him, and maybe that's just the purpose of it, right?
And actually that's a great point, because not everybody has read the book, or maybe they read the book and didn't connect with them, and maybe they need music and poetry and dance to make that connection. I think exploring things that happen to us in the arts is an excellent way of just processing.
Did you take a lot of joy in trying to put notes to your thoughts about Romeo.
Oh, I did. Yeah. I think like so many people in COVID times, we sort of reassess what's our life about? What are we doing? And while I love what I'm doing, I've kind of discovered that writing music for me is something I need to do more of. I had sort of gotten into it back in undergrad, but it fell away, as things do, especially things that are hard. But no, I've been really trying to do more and more of that over the last, well, couple of years now. So that's exciting.
Well, that is exciting to see all these people involved in this. So I guess the idea is that this thing is so huge, we're going to dole it out over time and I guess build in a crescendo to February when all of this stuff finally rolls out. So I'm sure that you and some of the others involved in this Remembering Romeo project will be back to tell us more.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Todd Hunt, a composer and one of the main organizers behind the Orpheus Project, a month-long celebration of the life and times of Romeo, the wolf who came to Juno.
The wild and the domestic. The wild and the domestic. The Dream of Eden. I find something about it has made me cry.
Juno has been a wild month, or rather January has been a wild month for Juno weather-wise, and we're not out of the woods just yet. Tom Matisse, CBJ's Emergency Programs Manager, is here to tell us why. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Boy, we have had some record rains, floods, roof-crushing snow, avalanche threats. What else can the weather throw at the city and borough of Juno and their emergency management department? Well, Tom Matisse and his crew always have to be ready, no matter what that might be. He is CBJ's Emergency Programs Manager. And Tom, I'd like to start off by asking you if you have ever seen a month like this.
Well, I'm sure in my lifetime I've seen a month like this, but not for response in Juno. And my history in Juno is shorter than most. I came in 2008. But since 2008, you know, we've seen over the course of those years, some of the wettest winters, some of the driest summers, some of the biggest snow winters, some of the driest snow winters. And this winter is just throwing it all at us. You know, we've seen some of the biggest snows in years. We've seen some of the coldest temperatures in years. We've seen some of the largest rain volumes in years. And all that's just leading to really interesting conditions that are keeping all the departments in the city on their toes, whether you're talking about Eagle Crest in the ski area or the plow crews from Public Works, or, you know, everybody's just doing their best this winter.
Well, what I'm wondering about, though, is I've noticed sort of a change in messaging, a real emphasis from the Weather Service and from your department about the consequences of some of the weather, what to expect. And I wonder, with so much unprecedented weather, there's probably got to be a lot of things you have to warn people about because they're just not used to thinking about those things. Is that the case for the stepped up messaging?
Well, we want to make sure that people are aware of the hazards that exist. I mean, that's the most important thing in my department, is not even just cataloging the hazards and discussing how we want to deal with them internally, but showcasing that to the community. And it's important to remember that mitigation of hazards comes in all forms. And the biggest thing we can do to start mitigation is education. And the more people understand these hazards, the more they can prepare themselves for these hazards, the better they can do when these hazards arise. And the more that helps all of our response entities throughout the city.
Well, I remember when just an unbelievable amount of snow fell in Juneau back in December, and I watched it just accumulate at an incredible rate because I had cleaned off my car and an hour later went out and there was another pile on top of it. And then, you know, you get all that snow and then it warms up and it's soggy. And I know that there were continual warnings to clear your roof, just be sure that you check your boats and things so that this heavy snow doesn't cause any problems. So it's probably a good thing you did that messaging because of what followed.
Well, you know, it's just really interesting because roof snow loads have only been an issue in a few issues. I mean, we haven't had a significant number of collapses, and yet that doesn't mean we haven't had a significant number of roof leaks, of pipes bursts, of other things that have caused all kinds of hazard for the community. I mean, including myself. I own a duplex and live in a duplex where the snow dams on the roof froze and the roof created leaks in new locations. And we had to shovel off that roof to get to those leaks. And then the rest of the roof slid and it ripped off snow stops and caused all kinds of damage to a house that I've been taking care of for 10 plus years and thought I had understood how to deal with.
Well, as far as the snow loads that were on roofs, did you see any common denominators in the buildings in which you had collapses? Was it age primarily?
I can't say that I've looked really closely at the buildings that have collapsed. There's only been a few, and we're very fortunate to that end. We have had mobile homes collapse, and we know the roofs are weaker on those structures. We've had industrial warehouse-type buildings collapse that have larger spans in the roof span. And we've had some older buildings collapse, but we're really thankful that the number of building collapses have been minimal, and citizens have done a great job to take care of those situations leading to danger on their own. There's so many people spent time shoveling and doing other things to try and buy down those dangers. And, you know, those are hard decisions to make, but I think people invested their time where they felt they need to. And thankfully we've done pretty good through all this.
So what are the takeaways from just the recent weeks that we've had with this?
Well, I think one of them is that how important community messaging is. I mean, we don't control Mother Nature, but when we get the biggest snow winter on record in 20 plus years, followed with temperatures that are 5 below average at the airport and 9 below average on Back Loop, followed with some of the biggest rains that we've seen in I don't know how long, those are conditions that are hard to deal with. And if individuals hadn't taken care of their own situation along the way and mitigated their own concerns along the way with roof plowing or roof shoveling and driveway plowing and drain clearing and all these other things, our community would be so much worse off today than it is. And I just really want to commend the Juneau residents for the effort they put forth in the last month, including the teamwork that I've seen and the camaraderie I've seen shared and people sharing resources and people sharing efforts and volunteering to help their neighbors. And it's all so critical to keep communities like ours online during these times of inclement weather. And it's been a unique winter in that we're not used to this kind of situation, and yet people have risen to the occasion and done a great job to protect themselves and their neighbors.
Well, with the flooding that we've had, you know, from the Riverbend School to road damage, boy, that was kind of another big slap in the face for the community.
Well, we're thankful that the governor included us in the regional disaster. You know, Yakutat had so much more snow than us and declared a local community disaster. As the governor was deciding how to move forward with that, he included the region in that disaster. That's opened up a little bit of avenue for resources for us on the public side. For government entities and others. And you know, we're thankful for that, but it's just really allowed us to understand the nature of the situation and focus on mitigation and focus on ways to protect our community as we try to work through this winter.
Well, with so much rain at once, was it appearing in places that you don't expect to see flooding?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the snow on the ground. And also, once you see significant ground cooling like we did, you see ice buildup in places that diverts the runoff. So you might have plowed your parking lot and you might think water goes from this corner to that corner. And all of a sudden, it's coming into your front door because Mother Nature put a chunk of ice in the wrong spot and nobody ever planned on that. And so it's been unique and interesting in that, especially in a low-lying community where we don't have a lot of slope or elevation, we have seen water pooling in so many unique locations that we have definitely struggled to deal with that. We're thankful that homeowners did a lot of preparations on their own, but the Public Works Department has been hunting drains for weeks, and thankfully they started early in the process. Otherwise, the flooding would have been so much worse. But we did experience some flooding, and they just kept on it and kept working through it. And I'm really thankful that the amount of flooding we saw was minimal compared to the amount of snow, the amount of ice, and the amount of rains that we've seen at record levels.
I know. I was out walking a bit today and just so glad that much of the ice has melted, so you're not having to worry about walking on wet, slippery ice. But I'm thinking, wow, you know, there's forecasting for snow over the weekend. It's going to get colder. So we start from ground zero again. And, you know, we have talked on this program before, Tom, about this pattern of freeze-thaw, and that sets the table for avalanche conditions. So I guess we've got a ways to go here before we can relax about the weather.
Well, you know, we could see avalanches all the way into May. And remember that in 2007, the Snettisham avalanche happened in mid-April. So we do have a long ways to go, and we need to keep paying attention. I'm thankful that people are checking the avalanche forecast at juno.org/avalanche. And I'm so very, very grateful that we haven't had any avalanche fatalities in our community since I've been here. But that's really a community that communicates, and a community that pays attention, and a community that talks with their partners and their friends and their ski partners. And people have been doing a great job of educating one another in the region. And we just need to keep elevating that, especially with climate change as conditions get more and more dramatic every year. It's not always more snow every year, but the conditions are definitely changing. Even the Basin Road avalanche this week was one of the bigger avalanches I've seen in our community, and it's January. We're going to keep increasing our snowpack. We're going to see more variable conditions. We're going to keep seeing avalanches, and it's going to be a long year. But thankfully, even though we've had some very large avalanches already, we haven't had anybody involved and we haven't lost any structures, and we're hoping that we can continue to maintain that.
So going forward for the rest of the winter, what's your advice for us to keep our eye on?
Well, that's a difficult question. You know, if you had asked me a month ago, I'd have said, worry about the snow. And then you look at me today and say, but it just rained 10 inches. So every day is different. Welcome to Juno. Pick up the dice, roll the dice, decide what to deal with. But in general, you know, if you're going to spend time in the mountains, if you're going to spend time out and recreating, it's good to understand the avalanche conditions and where the avalanches occur. If you're going to be dealing with your home and you're going to be dealing with your house, roof loads and snow in your driveways and snow around the drains all become so critical. And including even if you're going to go on vacation, not just having somebody look at your house, but saying, is there a water pipe dripping so my pipes don't freeze? Is there somebody actually looking at it on a daily basis? I had a vacant house. I had a problem. I created my own problem at some level because I maybe wasn't paying enough attention. So I'm one of those landlords who's paying for it myself through the educational curve. But at the same point in time, everybody needs to continue to do their best to protect their family and their investments and their community so that we can have a great winter and keep smiling.
So how's your budget doing with all the extra road maintenance and shoveling that you've had to do this winter?
Well, you know, that's really, it's public works and it's not Tom's to say, but I do know that they've been working really, really hard to do the best they can. The amount of time they have spent moving snow this year has been astronomical. I know that the governor's disaster declaration has the potential to help at some level, but this year we're going to probably be over budget on snow. And a lot of people say, you should do better. This should never occur. Why are we seeing snow build up on our sidewalks and other places? And yet we all know that if I developed a budget around the worst case scenario, and yet every year was on the average, you would look at me like I was crazy because I'm wasting taxpayer money. So we have to plan for the norm, and years like this are going to be a stress on the system. And we have to have the ability to flex to that stress with our internal resources, as well as with community support and other resources. This year, with labor shortages and other things, and COVID at its rampant climb through the community in the last several weeks, it's been difficult to keep people on the job. And so we know that we have shortages this year, unlike most years, and we're working through it. And we're thankful for all the overtime and all the effort, all the public works people and other departments have given, docks and harbors and streets and parks and DOT. And there's so many partners that come into this. We just can't thank everybody enough. But it's impossible to plan for the outlier years, and it's not responsible to budget for the outlier years. And this is one of those years. And so we're working through it. We're a little over budget, but we're doing the best we can.
Well, let's just hope that this is an outlier year. Well, I want to thank you, Tom Matisse. He is the Emergency Programs Manager for the City and Borough of Juneau. Always good to have your take on how we can better prepare for emergencies and stay safe. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
Sounds wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Hiking through the forest on a late summer afternoon, I spot a mushroom in a tree. It's a bolete, a popular edible mushroom with spongy pores under the cap instead of gills. It didn't grow in that tree. It was put there. A nibbled edge indicates a red squirrel likely carried that mushroom up into the tree. Red squirrels eat mushrooms, and they also dry them and store them for winter. Caribou eat mushrooms, and northern flying squirrels are well known to favor mushrooms and their fungal cousins, truffles, sniffing out and digging up those underground morsels. Red squirrels eat Amanita mushrooms, those beautiful red-capped and white-spotted toadstools that are toxic to people. But usually the same mushrooms prized by Alaskan mushroom hunters are the ones eaten by wildlife. Shaggy manes, chanterelles, puffballs, and chicken of the woods. Marks left on the half-eaten mushrooms provide clues to the diners. Small nibble marks left by mice and voles. Little V-shaped peck marks left by small birds. And large peck marks and broken-up mushroom caps. Evidence that a flock of ravens tucked into an entire patch of mushrooms. For Sounds Wild, I'm Riley Woodford.
Support for Juneau Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klingit and Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.
And that'll do it for Juneau Afternoon today. Tomorrow, we will have a presentation from the Black Awareness Association. Kelly Patterson will host this program, a conversation about interracial relationships. Until next time, thank you for joining the conversation. And from all of us at KTOO, gonna shchish and have a good evening.